it would be very difficult for our scientists to be doing the evaluations of a cement plant in Georgia and its impact that it's going to have on the polar bear habitat.
The Interior Department keeps a Bush administration rule on polar bears. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 8th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, whalers in Point Lay cut up their first whale in 70 years in the nick of time.
1 hour after we were done piling off the butchering, the wave action broke up the ice and the whale went into the water.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the state of Alaska.
The Interior Department will keep in place the polar bear rule, a Bush administration decision that says the Endangered Species Act can't regulate pollution that contributes to global warming. As APRN's Libby Casey reports, the state and oil industry are applauding the decision, but environmentalists say it's a huge disappointment.
The polar bear's sea ice habitat is melting, so 1 year ago, the Interior Department declared the animal threatened under the Endangered Species Act. But the Bush administration put in place the polar bear rule, which prohibits the Endangered Species Act from regulating development projects outside the Arctic that emit greenhouse gases. Officials said projects in the lower 48 should not be scrutinized because of their pollution emissions. Earlier this year, Congress gave the new Interior Secretary special authority to review the polar bear rule and possibly overturn it. But today, President Obama's administration stayed the course and stuck with the Bush-era rule. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar.
The single greatest threat to the polar bear is the melting of Arctic sea ice caused by climate change. The Endangered Species Act, however, is not, in my view, the proper mechanism for controlling our nation's carbon emissions.
Salazar says the Obama administration is pushing Congress to enact comprehensive climate change legislation to curb global warming and sea ice loss. The secretary spoke to reporters today by teleconference and said he's not diminishing the importance of what's happening to the polar bear.
To see the polar bear's habitat melting and an iconic species threatened is an environmental tragedy of the modern age. We must do all we can to protect the polar bear.
Salazar says scientists will closely monitor the polar bear's status and determine if new rules should be put in place to help protect them. But in the meantime, he says it's not realistic to use the Endangered Species Act to fight climate change.
I think it would be very difficult for our scientists to be doing the evaluations of a cement plant in Georgia and its impact that it's going to have on the polar bear habitat. I just don't think that the ESA was ever set up organizationally with that contemplation in mind.
The nation's leading oil and gas industry association applauded today's decision. So did the state of Alaska and its congressional delegation. John Katz, the director of Governor Sarah Palin's Washington, D.C. office, says in some respects, the Endangered Species Act is a blunt instrument.
The governor was very pleased by the secretary's decision. She had communicated previously with the secretary that we felt that the protections in the Marine Mammal Protection Act and the international treaties were sufficient to provide adequate protection to the polar bear, that there was no need to use the Endangered Species Act for that purpose.
Interior Department officials say activities in the Arctic, including oil and gas development, will be looked at and analyzed to see how they affect polar bears. They pointed out that the president's proposed budget calls for nearly $7.5 million for polar bear assessments and research. That includes $1.5 million to address consultations on oil and gas projects and to prepare a polar bear conservation plan. But environmentalists like Cassie Siegel with the Center for Biological Diversity biodiversity say if the Interior Secretary wants to save the polar bear, he needs to use the Endangered Species Act.
It makes absolutely no sense to say that we shouldn't use our nation's most successful law for the protection of plants and animals on the brink of extinction to protect the polar bear. The Endangered Species Act is not the full solution to global warming, but it's a big part of the solution. And saying we shouldn't use the Endangered Species Act is a nuanced way of saying let's do nothing about global warming for the polar bear right now.
Siegel says the Interior Department decision effectively takes away any power from the Endangered Species Act to actually protect the polar bear's melting home.
To try to tie the hands of the act and say that the Endangered Species Act can't be used to address the single greatest threat to the bear is illogical and it's illegal.
The Center for Biological Diversity has challenged the polar bear rule in court. The case was on hold as Salazar considered what to do with the law, but will now go forward. It's one of a jumble of lawsuits on the polar bear filed by groups in favor of protecting it and those against it. They've been consolidated into a single case with its first status conference in 2 weeks. It's before U.S. District Court Judge Emmett Sullivan, who presided over the Ted Stevens trial last fall. In Washington, I'm Libby Casey.
The Chukchi Sea coastal community of Point Lay is celebrating their first whale harvest in 72 years. Julius Rexford is the crew captain. He says Point Lay was down to only 3 residents through much of the 60s and 70s as many people went to boarding school and had moved out of the region. It wasn't until after the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, or ANCSA, was passed in 1971 that people started moving back. Then the long process of reestablishing their whaling history to make a case for a quota took place. Rexford says they had to work with the International Whaling Commission.
We did not have any paper trail to back up anything, so there had to be a neat study done and historical background on whaling, our whaling culture.
Rexford says they were given one strike just last year through the Alaska Eskimo Whaling Commission, but didn't get a whale in 2008. But this year, right after midnight on May 5th, the crew got a whale just 5 inches shy of 50 feet. He says they used 2 block-and-tackle setups and a whole lot of villager power to land the whale.
30 feet of the edge of the ice kept breaking off while we were pulling it up, but eventually we got it up. And 1 hour after we were done calling off the butchering, we got quite a bit of the good harvest on it. And the wave action from the west broke up the ice, and the whale eventually went into the water. But we did harvest about 90% of the whale.
Rexford says meat and muktuk cutters worked around the clock for 2 days to get the whale cut up and hauled into the village. He says mikyuk, a blend of whale meat, muktuk, and blood, is fermenting right now to share with village residents in an upcoming celebration. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Kuskokwim River flooding reaches Akiak.
And once this jam gets down to Bethel, I'm expecting Bethel's going to have some high water also.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
President Obama's proposed budget for fiscal year 2010 severely trims funding for Alaska programs. John Katz, Alaska's Director of State Relations in Washington, D.C., says there are 5 areas of concern he's closely watching as the budget process unfolds. The Denali Commission is in line for cuts to funding for programs aimed at worker training and health clinics.
It is expected that the base budget of the Denali Commission for their core purposes will be increased in the budget that the president announces next week, perhaps by as much as $10 million. But that won't compensate for the cuts that the president announced yesterday in terms of these specific programmatic areas.
Craig Johnson, Chief Operating Officer for the Denali Commission, says he's looking on the positive side. He says there will be a total of about $40 million in federal money for the commission this year.
You know, this $11.9 million in our base appropriation is actually the most we have received in a president's budget in the history of the commission. You know, it is a sign of support for the commission and what we're doing by the Obama administration.
Johnson says commission funding for the continuation of bulk fuel storage facilities and transportation is not affected. He says money for health facility construction, training programs, and energy grants for small villages, which were included in the 2009 budget, are significantly reduced under the proposed Obama budget.
We would not be able to continue to provide training opportunities for the construction jobs, the operations and maintenance jobs that we've been doing for the last 10 years. Without the funding for health facilities, we wouldn't be able to build the next clinic that is in need on our list.
The Obama budget is the commission's third smallest since its inception. In 2005 and 2006, it reached a high of $140 million in federal funds. According to CATS, water and sewer funds passed to the state through the Environmental Protection Agency are in the sights for some $10 to $19 million in cuts. The proposed budget also freezes the Fort Greely Missile Interceptor Program at its current level. The president has also proposed major changes in tax laws that affect the oil and gas industry on a national level. Katz says the impact on Alaska is not known at this time.
We know that Alaska is a high-cost environment for the oil and gas industry, that a lot of what they do in Alaska is right on the cusp of being profitable, and we just want to see how these cuts would affect their activities. Situation affecting the very large oil companies may be somewhat different than the independent companies.
Finally, an Obama proposal would roll funds allocated to individual states for salmon rehabilitation into funding for the Endangered Species Act. Katz says the conversion from state-by-state allocations to an ESA formula will overlook Alaska-specific salmon issues. He says under the Obama plan, funds destined for Alaska could be diverted to the lower 48 states, which have endangered salmon problems. Residents in the northwest community of Akiak are seeking higher ground after floodwaters began pouring into their village today. Breakup on the Kuskokwim River has been working its way downriver and flooding villages along the way. Akiak elders say water is almost as high as it's ever been in recent memory, and it's still rising. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports.
Forget trucks and four-wheelers. Kuskokwim waters have rendered them all but useless in much of Akiak. Bethel Search and Rescue President Peter Achak.
The roads are completely all submerged underwater at this time. So people are the volunteers and search and rescue people and the VPSO people are transporting the people from homes by skiff.
Akiak is located 30 river miles above Bethel. Achak met there with village leaders, the National Weather Service, and the state of Alaska to finalize emergency plans. For now, everyone in lower areas have headed to the high school. At least 50 residents are there already, and water levels are continuing to rise. Alaska State Trooper pilot Earl Samuelson did a flyby earlier this afternoon.
There was a huge jam from Akiak all the way back up towards the Kuskokwim and in front of Akiak and around the bend towards Jaunuck Slough.
The 15-mile ice jam has been backing water into Akiak all morning. The scene there earlier today was all hustle and bustle. Dog teams barked excitedly while Akiak residents moved them and other belongings to a safer place. Resident Lena Foss.
People are running around, moving stuff to the main highway, putting the dogs up, their freezers, vehicles. Most of the vehicles are up. Everybody's running around trying to get things onto higher ground.
Kuskokwim waters have already flooded villages further upriver, and the National Weather Service issued a flood warning for Akiak. Foss says she was still shocked by the pace of flooding once it started.
The water is still rising very fast. Water's coming up very fast. Bawakun and Unakun, some of the ice are floating by.
Water levels as of this afternoon were a foot and a half below the 1964 mark, which is the highest level village elders can recall. Floodwaters will continue to build until the ice jam releases, but that's not the end of the potential flood problems. Again, Trooper Pilot Earl Samuelson.
When that ice jam releases around Akiak, expect the water to rise in Akichuk and Kweekluk. And once this jam gets down to Bethel, I'm expecting Bethel's going to have some high water also.
Those communities are already on the verge of flooding. Downriver, about 15 miles in Kweekluk, water has been high for 3 days and continues to rise. Kweekluk resident Sam Jackson Jr. has been watching water slowly envelop his village. He says that some of the roads in the lower parts of the village began flooding this morning.
Water was dry. It's lots of water. And there's kids playing with rafts on top of the road.
Jackson says a lot of Kweekluk residents were working today to put their belongings on higher ground. He says there is one commodity that people are really looking out for this year.
Steam bath wood is more precious than everything. Steam bath wood is higher than everything else. Made me smile and laugh.
Akiak had several days to prepare for flooding. Peter Atchak with Search and Rescue says they plan on waiting it out at the high school for as long as they can.
At this time, the village has agreed to hold tight, and only at when extremely necessary, then they will call for evacuation.
It's been an irregular breakup on the Kuskokwim. Instead of one main front, there have been several, and ice near the mouth of the river is still strong. That is causing concerns that the worst might not yet be over. Reporting from Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
The Yukon River village of Beaver, that lies downriver from the flood devastation of the community of Eagle, evacuated elders and young children around noon today because the National Weather Service has advised village leaders that a wave surge could hit them later today. Rebecca Fisher is a Beaver Tribal Council member.
We have a couple rivers headed at us this way. We not only have the Yukon, we have Beaver River, we have the Porcupine, all draining towards us here. And from talking to Noah here, the problem that we have is the ice is solid from Beaver on down, so there's a good chance of a blockage there.
Fisher says Tanana Chiefs Conference is helping get the elders out, and the Village Corporation is helping pay to take the children to safety also.
And the last to go would be the chief and I and whoever else, but we're trying to get as many people who are going to be affected out of here.
Fisher says the village airstrip is surrounded by sloughs, so they won't have access if a flood hits. She says there are no roads to Beaver. National Weather Service River Forecast hydrologist Jim Coe says as of 3 p.m. today, the pan ice heading toward the village was about 10 miles out. He says there's no flooding yet, but there could be trouble after the ice passes through the community sometime later.
We're concerned because there's a natural constriction in the channel about 3 miles below Beaver. And so when the ice starts moving, it can jam up there, and the water can back up significantly behind that, which would then be a problem.
Coe says the ice was moving at a pace of around 10 miles in 4 hours earlier today. Fort Yukon had flooding last night. Fort Yukon police officer Peter Hobaker says water started coming into town around 10 p.m.
A side slough to the Yukon River jammed up with ice at the mouth, and it backed up into town. We had probably about 6 streets closed due to high water. Probably about the same number of houses were affected. I'd say about 6 residences had water in them.
Hobaker says water reached about 2.5 feet above flood level. He says damage was limited to water, with some homes being flooded by about 1 foot of water. He says the water started to recede around 2 a.m. this morning when the ice jam broke free. Hobaker says hydrologists flew from Circle to Fort Yukon this morning.
They think the worst is over. There's still some smaller chunks of ice coming between here and Circle, but they don't think it's going to pose any threat. The only thing that we think could pose a threat now is the Porcupine River, which hasn't gone out yet. Occasionally it has caused problems with flooding in Fort Yukon. Porcupine is on the backside of the town.
Habaker says about 50 residents in low-lying areas were evacuated last night to the school and radar base. Most are back home now. Habaker says Fort Yukon last experienced significant flooding in 1991. In Canada, a White Horse consultant says the Yukon's energy suppliers have given up on wind power in favor of expensive hydro projects. The former Yukon Energy Corporation engineer says millions of taxpayer dollars are riding on that decision. The CBC's Vic Extinko reports from this week's Utility Board hearings in Whitehorse.
Could someone please explain to me what a pothead is and what it does?
John Mason asked the question simply to demonstrate he knows it was a faulty pothead that caused the December 1st power outage across the Yukon. Mason is a big promoter of wind power. So Energy President David Morrison is cautious answering questions about the White Horse turbines.
I'm not the wind expert, Mr. Mason is, but one of the issues with the current wind turbines is their location.
Icing problems plague the Heckle Hill turbines each winter, but Mason says the turbines aren't even hooked into the energy company's central control station.
You'd think that this demonstration project, which was put in at considerable cost, would be operated seriously.
Instead, Mason says the company is pushing ahead with the expensive Mayo B Hydro expansion project. Costs are projected at $110 million.
Are we spending that money most wisely? I think if you built a wind power plant that could give you the same amount of energy as Mayo B, I think you could do it for probably half that cost.
Energy officials say wind power remains a steady option, but they say the Mayo Hydro expansion represents the easiest way to boost Yukon's energy supply. Vikaschenko, Whitehorse.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. APRN brings news about Alaska to public radio every day. APRN, we cover the stories that impact the lives of all Alaskans.
The Denali Mountain summer climbing season is barely underway, and the first death has been reported. 61-year-old William Hearn died on the approach to the Kahiltna Glacier. Hearn of Fairport, New York, was with a guided expedition traveling near Windy Corner yesterday when he collapsed and died. Park Service officials report that guides with the expedition immediately began administering CPR and were assisted by two National Park Service rangers who were in the area. CPR was performed for more than 30 minutes, but Hearn did not regain a pulse. There are currently about 150 climbers on Denali. Some new research related to North Pacific pollock and Pacific cod was unveiled recently at a science symposium in Anchorage. KDLG's Mike Mason was there and has this report.
Most of the presentations at the Alaska Marine Science Symposium focused on relatively short-term research and observations of fish and wildlife. However, Stuart Grant with the University of Alaska unveiled some research detailing the response of North Pacific pollock and Pacific cod to climate events over hundreds of thousands of years. He noted that in the last 800,000 years, there's been tremendous variability in climate, temperature, and sea levels.
And you can see that there's major warmings about every 100,000 years. These are the Milankovitch cycles. You can also see that our present warming period is quite unusual over this time and over the period of the evolution of the fishes in the North Pacific and Bering Sea.
Grant pointed out some of the ways the North Pacific and the Bering Sea have changed over the past several thousand years.
The Bering Strait has been open only about 20% of the time because of lowered sea level. About 80% of the time, much of the Chukchi Shelf and the Bering Sea Shelf has been essentially dry land. So the Bering Sea, North Pacific, have been much different over much of the Pleistocene.
Grant said the pollock and cod populations were greatly impacted by the massive glaciers that ranged along the North Pacific coastline.
There were massive glaciers extending from Puget Sound along British Columbia, around the Gulf of Alaska, and along the Aleutians. And these had glacial events had a tremendous effect on population abundances of, in particular, pollock and North Pacific cod in the North Pacific. They produced decreases in plankton productivity, and they eliminated the nearshore nursery areas, and most likely led to the extinctions of much of the pollock and Pacific cod biomass in the central part of the North Pacific.
The new research included DNA samples of pollock and Pacific cod from locations across the North Pacific, including from Puget Sound across to the Sea of Japan. Grant and his fellow researchers were able to use the DNA samples, along with computer modeling, to come up with some estimated historic population figures for pollock.
There appear to have been two refuge areas, two refugia in the North Pacific. Pretty good signal that most of the populations went extinct in the center part of the North Pacific and Bering Sea, and have been recolonized since the last glaciation from these more southern glaciations. We see a signature of population expansion, and we have a contact zone in the western Bering Sea.
Grant says the data and the computer modeling shows a much more complicated history for Pacific cod.
Gene flow apparently is much less. There's a strong signal of isolation by distance. The mitochondrial DNA data give indication that there were two or three refugia. The northern refugia is probably associated with what's been described for other species as the Haida refugia off Queen Charlotte Islands. And as you saw, we have signatures in the center of the North Pacific of recent population expansions and a contact zone also in the western Bering Sea.
Pacific cod is a bottom dweller and is currently found mainly along the continental shelf and upper slopes, with a range around the rim of the North Pacific from the Yellow Sea to the Bering Strait and south down to an area off the coast of California around Los Angeles. North Pacific pollock range from the Bering Sea to central California in the eastern Pacific, and in the western Pacific they're found around the Aleutian Islands off of Kamchatka and in the Sea of Japan. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Shane Iverson in Bethel, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and the CBC's Vic Ischinko in Whitehorse, Yukon. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Ellen Lockyer from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company, and by Alaska Communications Systems, serving Alaskans across the state with vital telecommunications since before statehood. ACS, providing voice and high-speed broadband solutions, connects Alaska to the rest of the world. Didn't quite catch that report? Want to hear it again? APRN can be heard on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.